I'm Peter Medlin, and you are listening to Teacher's Lounge from WNIJ. And if this is your first time hearing our show, I've got good news. It's based on a really simple idea that we've all had teachers in our lives who helped us become who we are today. And every educator we have on this podcast, whether it's a traditional classroom teacher, a coach, a professor, everyone is nominated by the folks who listen. So we want you to be a part of this with us. So please do tell us about the educators who've inspired you and the folks in your community who you think deserve a spotlight. You can email us with your nominations and your story ideas at teachersloungeatniu.edu. Now today on the show, I have to start off by saying Happy New Year, everyone. Full disclosure, I am recording this still in 2025, and so it's still a little bit weird for me to say 2026, but before we get too far into the new year, I want to take one last look back in the rear view to 2025. Now, we've already shared a few of our favorite conversations from the past year, but Teachers Lounge is way more than just the interviews we have with the educators you nominate. This show is also a platform for the in-depth education reporting we produce at WNIJ, so today we are going to revisit a few of the stories that stuck out to us this year. Now, some of them are very serious, some of them are uplifting or even fun, but I think that they are all important. So first up, way back in February, Illinois lawmakers had just introduced legislation to ban school-based ticketing. It's where students receive fines for city ordinance violations for in-school behavior. In the fall of 2019, when Amara Harris was a junior at Naperville North High School, she was accused of stealing a classmate's AirPods. She says she was looking for hers and grabbed the wrong pair by accident before realizing the mistake and returning them to the dean. Still, Harris was ticketed by school police, which included a fine of up to $500. Harris and her mother, Marla Baker, decided to fight the ticket. It took years, but in 2023, a jury found her innocent.
The 4.5 year process was very, very hard on us emotionally, physically, mentally, financially. Just to be holding your breath for 4.5 years, not knowing how her future would look.
Her mom says Amara's had trouble opening up and trusting people since then. She'd never been in trouble before. She was worried if having a ticket on her record would hurt her ability to get scholarships or her license to become a veterinarian.
As a mom, there's nothing I could do to give those 4.5 years back to her. There's nothing. She's not the same. She's changed.
They also filed a federal civil rights lawsuit against the city of Naperville. And Harris's school district isn't the only one where students are ticketed. Last year, two organizations filed a federal civil rights complaint against Rockford Public Schools, alleging discriminatory discipline practices, including their use of school-based ticketing. Over the past two full school years, school police wrote Rockford students more than 250 city ordinance violation tickets for in-school behavior. That adds up to $58,329 worth of fines. Nicholas Meyer is the city of Rockford's former legal director. He oversaw those code violation hearings.
Small fine can be an effective tool to deter behavior. I do believe that.
At districts like RPS, students caught with marijuana don't just get a detention or suspension from their school, they also receive a ticket. Most of the citations were for possession of less than 30 grams of cannabis, but others were for trespassing, and some students who got in fights received breach of peace tickets. The tickets usually cost around $150, but can be as high as $750. To contest it, they have to show up at a code meeting at City Hall on a Wednesday during the school day. Families generally have 30 days to pay the fine, and if they don't, Meyer says they don't hound families for the money. But those fees can skyrocket if they're sent to a collections agency. Documents obtained by WNIJ say that many of the tickets were sent to collections, but Meyer says that they never were.
No cases were ever sent to collections. That would have gone through our finance department. We have no record of that. Yeah, it was just sort of a quirk in the system. But we have not and will not be sending cases to collections.
He says that nearly $60,000 is more than he expected, but that not every ticket gets paid since they don't send families to collections. Only two tickets have been issued to students this school year, both of which are still pending. And the city's legal department says they're working on an agreement with the school district to stop school-based ticketing. And RPS says there are certain offenses, like drug possession, that they're legally mandated to notify the police about. It's not the schools writing the ticket. Connecticut, it's the police, even if those police officers are contracted with the district. Amy Galvin is with the education advocacy group Stand for Children, and she says even if that's true, there are plenty of communities where students aren't ticketed.
In our research and our outreach, we have found that those schools are functioning perfectly well.
State Representative LaShawn Ford just introduced a bill to stop school-based ticketing. His bill changes the Illinois school code to ban school personnel, including school police, from issuing tickets for municipal code violations.
Catch young people with like a vape pen. I don't know if police need to be involved in that. I mean, you could simply take it.
Galvin with Stand for Children says schools have better options to correct misbehavior and that ticketing just punishes families. Back in Naperville, Amara's mom's advocacy now extends far beyond just her daughter. Marla has been meeting with school administrators around the state to try to end school-based ticketing in Illinois. She says that no family should have to go through the stress that hers did, and that she hopes Representative Ford's legislation can make sure of it. Early in the 2024-25 school year, hundreds of Rockford Public School students didn't receive their mandated occupational therapy, and so I investigated special education shortages to learn why so many students went unserved for so long.
Peter, a few months ago, you reported on a shortage of social workers in Rockford Public Schools. As you were doing that reporting, you started to hear from occupational therapists who had worked in the district about some of their concerns. So to start off, what does an occupational therapist do?
So an occupational therapist helps people participate in their daily lives, like work activities, things like that. And so, you know, what's an elementary school student's occupation? Well, their job is learning. So occupational therapists help kids learn how to use their hands with classroom materials like pencils and scissors so they can write and make art in class. And they also help many students with things like sensory processing. And I got to speak with Wendy Sigona. She just retired after over 30 years as an occupational therapist with Rockford Public Schools. And she says that over the past year or so, the district's made it more difficult for students to get that therapy they need.
And if you don't get those services early on, then it's very frustrating because they already are delayed and the gaps just get bigger.
How many students did this shortage impact?
So this fall, 400 Rockford Public School students sat on a wait list not receiving their legally required occupational therapy.
Why so many?
So the district says it was because of staffing shortages, but according to emails that we obtained, the district made the choice to significantly reduce its OT staffing levels.
What did you find about why they did that?
So Sigona believes that they were trying to save money by hiring therapists directly. Like many school districts, Rockford contracts with an outside agency, the Northwestern Illinois Association, for some of its special education services like occupational therapy. And last spring, Rockford abruptly informed that agency that they were going to be ending their contract, cutting all 18 of their occupational therapists. But the district discovered that legally they couldn't do that. So instead, they requested to reduce staffing at the maximum level possible in a single year under the contract, which was 25%. So it would take them down from 19 to 14 occupational therapists for this school year.
The Northwestern Illinois Association, what was their reaction to that?
In ensuing emails, NIA staff are very concerned. Their CEO, John Malone, asked Rockford Special Education Administrators what staffing formulas they used to calculate that they'd still be able to adequately meet student needs since there wasn't a reduction in the number of students who need occupational therapy.
And then how did the occupational therapists respond?
So Rockford also wanted to take over managing occupational therapy caseloads, and that sudden shakeup left their occupational therapists with a lot of questions and worried that they'd soon be out of a job. In April, Malone informed Rockford that three of their full-time occupational therapists assigned to Rockford had resigned, quote, citing the uncertainty about future working conditions within the Rockford Public Schools as the primary reason for leaving, and they're also anticipating another resignation imminently, and five total occupational therapists ended up resigning last spring. That includes someone we'll call Chris, who spoke to us and asked us not to use their real name. He worked at the elementary and early childhood level at Rockford for several years, and he said that he had to make the decision to leave for another job he knew would be more steady, and it was a very difficult decision because he did really love the work he did there. But again, he'd only been there for a few years, so he was afraid his position would be part of that 25% cut. But on top of that, he'd grown more and more frustrated with what he called a, quote, clearly coordinated decline of service by the district.
A clearly coordinated decline of service. What did he mean by that?
He says the district made decisions based on money, not on student needs. And Wendy Sigona was discouraged too. Wendy and Chris were both part of special education teams who evaluated students to see what services they needed and if they could succeed in a general education class or if they needed special programming. But she says more and more administrators were coming in more and more often to tell them that their placement evaluations were wrong.
And you can come and look at the kid for one blink of an eye and say, no, we're going to put him in regular program. We have to try it first because that's least restrictive. No, it's not least restrictive if those kids aren't able to access any of the curriculum that's happening within that program.
So after cutting a quarter of positions and then having several OTs quit, how difficult was it for the district to hire enough therapists in time for the beginning of the school year?
It was really difficult. And even by the summer, they were still several occupational therapists short of what they requested. Now, by then, emails show that Rockford administrators acknowledged that even if they hired all 14 therapists they requested, it still might not be enough to meet student needs. And we asked Rockford Special Education Director Michael Raya if the district knew before the school year that students would have to be put on wait lists. Raya said no, but in an August email, right before the first day of school, Raya sent over language therapists should use when asked about unserved students. He said, quote, "The district is currently looking for more OTs and PTs. We are currently understaffed and therefore some students will be without services and need to go on a compensatory wait list." And the email finishes, quote, "We are actively looking to fill our shortages in these positions, but understand the nature of our reality."
Were they ever able to hire enough occupational therapists this school year?
The district started filling OT positions throughout the fall semester, eventually getting even more than those 14 they'd originally asked for. And to cut down on wait lists, they also hired virtual occupational therapists to deliver therapy services over the computer. Raya says that 20% of students receiving occupational therapy are still receiving it virtually. And some therapists like Sigona say it's not very effective, especially if the paraprofessional, the person helping guide the lesson on the student side of the computer screen, doesn't have much experience with OT.
So much adjusting that you just automatically do with your skills in OT. And if you're doing that through a screen with someone else and explain the kind of adaptations that you want to be in place, you don't get very much done.
Even if they disagree, do therapists like Sigona say they understand why the district made these decisions?
No. Overall, Sigona is still confused about what exactly happened over the past year.
I just don't understand their reasoning, their thought process, what seems to be a lack of planning.
What's the situation like now? Are there still students on the wait list?
No. So Michael Raya says that no Rockford students are currently on wait lists, but therapists like Wendy Sigona and Chris say that there wouldn't have had to have been hundreds of kids on wait lists in the first place if the district hadn't decided to cut so many positions with the Northwestern Illinois Association. They've worked with the agency for decades using this model of OT service delivery, and so they're still wondering why the sudden shift. And Chris not only quit working with Rockford, the experience made him leave education altogether, but he says he's not the victim here. He says the OTs will be fine. They'll get jobs other places. It's the families who suffer. And he says that he doesn't see the district worried enough about that. And a spokesperson for the Northwestern Illinois Association says that they remain committed to supporting all of their district partners, including Rockford, in meeting their occupational therapy needs. And in March, Texas was experiencing its largest measles outbreak in 30 years, and I spoke with a religious studies professor about the growth of religious exemptions to vaccines here in Illinois. Last year, more than 25,000 Illinois students from both public and private schools received a religious exemption for the measles vaccine. That's up about 90% from a decade before, according to data from the Illinois State Board of Education. Other states, like Texas, allow for exemptions based on a, quote, reason of conscience, like a religious belief. Those exemptions led to lower vaccination rates in Gaines County, where the measles outbreak began and spread among the county's Mennonite Christian community. In Illinois, religious exemptions are the only non-medical exemption families can seek. And back in 2015, Illinois made it more difficult to receive religious exemptions. The state passed a law that made parents and guardians submit an exemption form that both details the, quote, specific religious beliefs that conflict with immunization and requires them to get the form signed by the child's health care provider. It's then up to the school to decide if the objection is valid or not. It's probably not a surprise that the Illinois schools with the most religious exemptions Christians are religious schools, and many of those schools have seen significant increases in the percentage of students who received exemptions. A private Christian school in suburban Cook County had the most objections last year. In the past 5 years, they've gone from 11% to 30% of their students receiving them, and others have gone from 10% to 25% or 1% to 10% in that same time span. And it's important to note that, as those numbers indicate, it's still a minority of families at these schools who are seeking these waivers, but why exactly are they seeking them so much more now as opposed to 5 or 10 years ago? Max Perry Mueller is an associate professor of religious studies and history at the University of Nebraska, and he says, just think about what's happened in the last 5 years.
I do think COVID is the obvious and clear catalyst to the increase in these exemptions.
But COVID doesn't explain everything. For one, Mueller says it doesn't explain why the politicization of the COVID vaccine would spill over into denial of other vaccines like MMR for measles.
COVID was the catalyst that drove up exemptions, but it was a movement within these communities, especially on the religious right, the evangelical religious right, of skepticism, if not hostility to institutions and their expertise, especially bureaucratic expertise.
Mueller says that distrust of government institutions and, by extension, public schools had been building since Reagan and the so-called moral majority. Then COVID became a perfect catalyst to weave mistrust of vaccines more clearly into the worldview that the government exerts too much control over their lives and the lives of their children. But the religious exemption form families submit does ask people to detail specific religious beliefs that conflict with immunization. Is there a particular set of Bible verses commonly cited by those seeking an exemption? Well, a 2021 post from the Christian think tank The Family Research Council outlines how families can justify religious exemptions by citing a verse from the book of Romans that says, quote, "For whatever does not proceed from faith is sin." So Christians shouldn't willfully act against their conscience. Mueller says this is an example of what theologians call proof texting.
The Bible is such a complex text that you can make it say anything you want, and people have for millennia.
But Mueller says that's not to say these anti-vaccine beliefs are insincere.
These folks are coming from a genuine place of care for their children. They think that they're doing what's best for their children.
And again, this is still a minority view. Most people do see the value of vaccines. But Mueller doesn't think anti-vaccine sentiment is a short-term COVID area phenomenon either. He thinks this is a generational shift that was a long time coming. And Mueller thinks there's only one thing that could change that.
And what will change it, and I do believe eventually it will change, is unfortunately mass outbreaks and mass suffering.
When measles vaccination rates dip below 95% in a community, that's when the risk of an outbreak begins to climb. In Gaines County, Texas, where the current outbreak started, the measles vaccination rate was 82%. In Illinois, there are only two counties, both at the southern tip of the state, with rates below 90%. In early April, the Trump administration revoked the visas of international students across the country, often with little or no reason offered as to why, and that included students at Northern Illinois University. And I spoke with a few of those international students on campus who were feeling really anxious. The news just broke as I drove to campus.
Five international students at Northern Illinois University have had their visas revoked.
It's so recent that several of the international students I meet with don't even know yet.
Just hearing this.
Really?
I don't know if you guys had... No, this is my first time hearing this.
This is the first time we know.
And now you have like,
yeah, so I'm so surprised.
They're all graduate students, originally hailing from different parts of Asia and Africa. They requested anonymity because they're scared the Trump administration will revoke their visas for speaking out against its policies.
What are we supposed to do as graduate students? You know, we come from different countries. We start everything from scratch. We're paying our tuitions on time. You know, there's all these things we're doing correctly. What more are we supposed to do? Like, I heard that they are revoking visas for having parking tickets, which is insane.
Several students said those NIU students weren't told why their visas were being revoked. An NIU spokesperson says the university communicated directly with each student the reason for the visa revoking listed in the government-managed system, but if the reason is vague or unclear, NIU doesn't have a way of knowing anything beyond what's listed. Either way, the students say it feels like the Trump administration is inventing reasons to target them. They used to feel safe on campus, but...
Not anymore. Not after this morning. So I'm just guessing everything I do now. I'm like, should I do this or should I not? Should I buy Asian groceries? You know.
They're scared to speak out. They're scared of traveling, of posting on social media, or yes, even going to an Asian or African grocery store in fear of being pulled into a car by federal agents like Tufts University student Rumeysa Ozturk.
A few days back, I think being extra cautious was good, but now I'm being extra scared, actually.
Yeah.
One student is traveling domestically soon and is a little concerned about an essay they wrote several years ago criticizing the Trump administration's immigration policies.
This is from 3 years ago. And I'm like, oh, I've had to consider, well, I probably should delete it from my computer or save it on the cloud or something in case I come into contact with immigration agents.
Some of the students are just weeks away from getting their diploma, but now they're not sure they'll be able to graduate. Maybe they'll get deported first and saddled with a student debt. They say it's extremely disheartening, knowing how hard they worked to get here, from the exams, the visa interview, the statement of purpose convincing the university they're worth bringing, and finally the pressure to be the best in your classes.
We are actually paying almost three times the tuition that a normal in-state student would pay for a graduate student. And if you check the stats, we are on top of all our classes in most cases. We are, you know, we're adding to the economy a lot. I don't see how we are the problem here.
Their families back home are freaked out too. For some, it's changed their perception of America. They were raised on the idea of a land of opportunity and free expression for all.
The place I come from, we were in our constitution inspired fundamental rights from USA. We got it into our constitution from them, but I don't think it is like uphill that much because we're like boasting about the right to
freedom of speech
and all those stuff. But
is there like, freedom of speech? There is no freedom of speech.
So that is a question here.
A few weeks ago, NIU President Lisa Freeman issued a statement saying that international students are a valued part of the community. But these students say they want the university to be more clear about how they can support them and what their options actually are.
How does that support actually materialize when the going gets tough? I have no idea.
WNIJ requested an interview with the university's International Student and Scholar Services, but they declined. Amid it all, it's been hard to keep their head down and focus on their studies, but they say they have to persist.
Choosing to remain positive. I'm doing everything within my power to be a law-abiding alien, as they say, law-abiding international student.
Several of the students still want to stay and build a life here in the U.S. They say they've done everything right. They love their friends and their community. They're excited about their future in America. But they say it's feeling more and more like they're not wanted, like they're being shoved out the door by any means necessary. Later on in the spring, Illinois lawmakers considered a measure to give schools guidance on how to use artificial intelligence, or AI. And I got to report on how teachers in Rockford were already using that AI in the classroom.
I am here to share my experiences and answer your questions about my work as a conductor on the Underground Railroad, my life, and the fight for freedom. What would you like to know?
That's a custom AI chatbot that answers student questions as if it's abolitionist Harriet Tubman. It's built using Magic School, one of the most popular AI platforms designed for schools. Last year, Rockford Public Schools paid over $200,000 for several years of Magic School's premium service. The district's educational technology coordinator, Susan Urim, says elementary schoolers are learning about the Underground Railroad with this chatbot.
It wasn't about fantasy. It was about being engaged in a conversation with somebody in a way that we couldn't have done without this technology.
So I asked the AI Harriet Tubman how they stayed safe while leading slaves to freedom.
When we needed to be quiet, I'd carry a bit of ginger root in my pocket to give to babies to keep them from crying.
One problem, there's no evidence to support that Tubman actually did that. It's an example of an AI hallucination. The chatbot also mentioned that she had a $40,000 bounty on her head, which is a common legend about Tubman that's also not accurate, but is a mistake a student might make. And as those examples show, this technology's not flawless. And that's before you consider AI's heavy environmental impact and the ethics of AI image generators scraping work from artists for training data. But AI is already in classrooms across Illinois, whether teachers like it or not. And it's one reason why State Representative Laura Favor-Diaz introduced a proposal establishing a State Instructional Technology Advisory Board. Favor-Diaz is a former teacher, and she says cell phones have been an issue in schools for years, and the state's just getting around to crafting policies, so it's crucial they don't wait that long with AI.
They're able to act nimbly and quickly to pull together experts, including classroom teachers in terms of practice. And then that first guidance will be issued July 1st, 2026.
At this point, she says the state really doesn't know how local schools use AI. In Rockford, Susan Urim says they started training teachers on AI a few years ago after students started using ChatGPT to write their essays. But they knew the tech wasn't going anywhere and teachers needed to understand it better.
How do you understand bias? How do you understand privacy and security? How do you understand the idea of hallucinations or quality of output? And then on top of that, be a good prompt engineer.
They went with Magic School because it's created specifically for the classroom. It has templates for teachers and it allows them to monitor how their students are interacting with the AI. She says there are tons of ways Rockford teachers use Magic School, from those historical figure chatbots to building IEPs and lesson plans. Douglas MacArthur is an English teacher at Jefferson High School, and right now he says tools like Magic School are useful, but not quite revolutionary. He lets his kids use it for brainstorming topic ideas and cleaning up grammar, but not for original writing.
If you have the machine do the thinking for you, then you're not growing as a person, and therein lies the problem.
Brent Fritz is an engineering and math teacher at Roosevelt High School, and he used to spend weeks at home after school overhauling curriculum, days of copying and pasting into spreadsheets. He uses AI to increase his efficiency.
I did that again just recently. And it went from like 3 weeks, we'd say, to about 6-7 hours.
Fritz says it also helps customize assignments. Got students who love Minecraft? Great, here are 4 Minecraft-themed word problems. He says that AI's integration in the classroom has really made him reflect on which parts of his job are essential and can only be done by a human, and what he's comfortable outsourcing to AI.
AI is not going to build relationships for you. But as an educator, like, that's the most powerful tool I have is the relationship I have with my students. If they don't trust you, they're not going to buy what you sell.
Fritz says AI could revolutionize education. Who knows what these tools will look like in 10 years, but honestly, he just hopes it cuts out busy work to give him more time to pay attention to what matters most, building relationships with his students. Over the summer, immigration enforcement really picked up in Illinois, and I want to talk about how that impacted students and kids. And so I talked with 2 immigrant families in Rockford who were trying to settle into life in a new country while immigration raid fears grew. Some of the individuals we spoke to came to the U.S. seeking political asylum, while others arrived through a Biden-era humanitarian parole system. At the end of his term, Biden chose not to extend that program, which the Trump administration ended. Now, immigrant families using that legal pathway have to seek other options while worrying they could be detained by ICE without their day in immigration court. Rosa and her 3 kids moved to Rockford about 1.5 years ago after a long, dangerous journey from Ecuador. They traveled through treacherous jungles and areas known for armed kidnappers. She knew the risks and said she would do anything to give her kids better education opportunities and escape violence in her former country.
Yo moriera por cuidar a mis hijos.
So, for example, I would die to take care of my kids.
We chose not to use Rosa's real name due to privacy concerns in the U.S. and in her home country of Venezuela. Making that perilous trip with 3 young kids was challenging, and she didn't want to scare them, so she tried to hide how much danger they were actually facing.
Como niño, lo tomaron como un tour.
With kids, the way that I treated it was like we were going on a tour.
The person translating is Amanda Mayle from Rockford Action for Immigrants. They help resettle families like this and assist with housing, clothing, legal services, and more. Rose's 3 kids are all in school in Rockford now, and she says it's been a difficult transition, particularly for her middle schooler. New country, new language, new school, it was overwhelming. But then volunteers helped him find a soccer team, which Rosa says has been like therapy for him.
Sin embargo, cuando ya empezó con el fútbol, ya venía cansado, ya, o sea, la adaptación fue mejor.
And it helped him a lot. He wasn't even sleeping. And then he got into soccer, and he would come back tired and would sleep.
Her daughter just graduated high school and plans to enroll in college.
Un orgullo y quiero que siga estudiando porque no quiero que ella pierda ese ánimo.
For me, it's such a proud moment, like as a mom, and I want her to keep studying because I don't want her to lose that energy and that drive.
After the long journey, she says they're finally realizing their dreams. But the increase in immigration raids and detentions have her worried. A few weeks ago, her son was at soccer practice when news of ICE sightings in Rockford reached them. Her daughter was supposed to have a college meeting, but they stayed home out of fear. And on the other side of Rockford, 2 brothers also moved to the city nearly 2 years ago. We'll call them Luis and Francisco, and they're originally from Nicaragua. They're both fathers of twins, but their kids had to stay behind. Luis says the public education system in Nicaragua isn't very good, but now, thanks to the money they're earning in the U.S., they can afford to send their kids to private school.
Darle lo mejor, un futuro mejor. Actualmente estudian inglés, algo que yo allá no le podía pagar.
They're studying English now. Before, I wouldn't have been able to provide that opportunity for them.
Francisco says it's been really hard and stressful being away from them for so long, but they still get to call each other every day. And Luis says they talk about the chores they're helping their mom with and how they want to come to the U.S. to study someday.
Que todos los días le piden a Dios para que podamos estar juntos.
And every day we are asking God to bring us together.
Francisco looks at a photo of his family on the beach where they ate together for his going away party, and Luis thinks about saying goodbye to his children.
Pero sí, el último día, pues, de que miré a mi hija llorar cuando yo me venía para acá.
It was hard on my last day at home to watch my one little girl cry so much.
And despite immigration concerns, they still hope that one day they'll be reunited here in the U.S. to keep pursuing their American dream as a family. And as the school year was getting started this fall, I got the chance to dive deep into some data. So a teacher is considered out of field when they're teaching a grade level or a subject that they're not licensed by the state to teach. And in Illinois, it was about 4% of all teachers who were considered out of field last year. But in one district, it had ballooned all the way to 37%. Over the winter, Kankakee School District Superintendent Teresa Lance met with every one of their nearly 80 uncertified instructors and gave them a choice.
One, they can decide to go back to school, or two, they can move into a substitute position for the 25-26 school year. But I was going to be recommending their termination for the upcoming school year if they opted not to go back to school to get their license.
Dozens agreed to get their license, and dozens of others were dismissed. It was Lance's first year as the superintendent. But how did Kankakee get to the point where their percentage of uncertified teachers was 9 times the state average? Beth Anderson says it began about a decade ago. She's a special education teacher of the district and the head of the teachers union. She says staff knew the status quo could not continue.
It felt like to us that we were just pushing students through. So giving, you know, the gentleman's F, the D minus. And we wanted to address that.
They wanted to be bold, to find the cutting edge of education to help them thrive.
So the state of Illinois offered the pilot program.
The pilot was for competency-based education, or CBE. Anderson says it's a model where students can prove their knowledge outside of traditional coursework, integrate real-world issues, and crucially, where schools can hire people with industry experience to teach.
So for example, we have health clinics in our high school, and the doctor that served that clinic taught biology in the high school.
CBE started slowly, just with high school freshmen, then rolled up to sophomores the next year, and so on. It was not meant to be implemented at lower levels, and in the first few years, they only hired a few non-certified instructors, so it was easier for experienced teachers to mentor them as they got settled into the classroom.
I think that gave administrators and community members the impression that this was a really good thing, that we could train people on the job, you know, and that it would work. And it would be another opportunity to also address the teacher shortage.
90% of their students are considered low income, and low income districts like Kankakee tend to have the highest teacher vacancy rates. And partially because of those shortages, Lance says they started to get a little too loose with their CBE waiver.
Unfortunately, we use the teacher shortage as, in my opinion, a crutch to continue to hire non-licensed instructors.
Anderson agrees that when filling positions got tough, it became a path of least resistance. She says at the same time, several administrators left, which led to fewer professional development opportunities for the instructors, fewer mentorships, and less oversight to monitor how well competency-based education was even working. And the number of non-certified teachers expanded at the high school and even started dripping down to the lower level schools in roles where instructors were never supposed to be. Lance says they were in pretty much every content area, but they had the most in math, science, and special education.
So what I found out from the state is that we never should have had instructors in special education.
And as the number of instructors grew, Anderson says it started a downward spiral.
We started to have so many instructors and a system that just could not support their needs.
It caused conflicts between licensed and non-licensed teachers. Anderson says there was a mass exodus of teachers, which made it even tougher for the remaining teachers and instructors.
It's very difficult to watch someone flounder, to watch the students suffer because they don't have a teacher, you know, that can meet their needs. And so the whole culture just turned to be very difficult, stressful.
Students were struggling academically, and Lance says it was the first thing on her mind when she took the superintendent job last year.
I wasn't suggesting that not having licensed teachers was the only reason our students weren't performing well on state assessments, but I was absolutely saying that that was a contributing factor.
They spent the past year reversing course, and Lance says the goal is to have a fully licensed teacher in every Kankakee classroom by 2027. And to do that, they're on an aggressive recruiting campaign. They're staffing job fairs, hiring international teachers, and partnering with universities to bring in student teachers they hope will stay on after graduation. And obviously, they're encouraging their unlicensed teachers to get licensed. Lakita Foster is one of the instructors earning her teaching credential. She's been teaching 6th grade at Kankakee's Kennedy Middle School for the past 2 years. And while Foster may not have the right credential, she did come into the classroom with experience.
I was a preschool teacher for 6 years. My background was already in education.
She was recently accepted into the Golden Apple Accelerators program, which helps career changers get licensed to teach in specific targeted schools. And she'll be taking classes for the next year before she earns her credential.
When school starts back for us, that's when we actually go into student teaching. But since I'm already teaching my own classroom, they'll just set me up with a mentor.
Even though Foster already has a degree and experience in education, the jump from preschool to middle school is still really hard. It's a vastly different age group and skill set. She remembers her first few weeks scrambling to understand the curriculum.
I started to feel more comfortable because I took the time myself. I would bring it home with me and just look it over and review myself.
Now that Foster feels secure in what she's teaching, she can focus more on building meaningful relationships with her students. Union President Beth Anderson says Foster's story is familiar. She says plenty of their instructors had classroom experience and did great work.
We do have some licensed teachers who are teaching outside of their license. So they might have taught 6th grade for 20 years in the district, and now they're teaching 8th grade math.
Anderson says that all of the instructors had to have at least a substitute teaching license. They were also supposed to have a bachelor's degree in a related field, but again, over the past few years, that wasn't always carried out in the right way. But now, through Kankakee's aggressive recruiting, Superintendent Lance says they're making real progress.
Instead of 40% of folks out of field, we are now closing that gap. We won't have more than 10 to 15% of people out of field or out of licensure.
And aside from the instructor issue, they have to decide whether or not to keep the competency-based education model. Lance says they're in the middle of a curriculum audit to figure out what's working and what's not. But no matter what path they choose, they feel better knowing that every student will be taught by a teacher who can help them succeed. Earlier on this year, Northland College, a small college in northern Wisconsin, abruptly closed down, leaving students scrambling. Now, one of the many losses was this school's proud hockey program, and that was until another Wisconsin college stepped up to give the wayward teams a new home. Playing this game is a privilege. Don't take it for granted. Shane Buckley's preached it to his players countless times coaching college hockey. He heard it himself back when he played. You never know when you'll lace your skates for the last time.
February of 2025, got an email on a Wednesday basically saying, hey, the school is closing down. So that weekend was actually playoffs for hockey. So we weren't even done with our season yet.
Buckley was the head men's hockey coach at Division III Northland College, a tiny school steps from Lake Superior, which was also his alma mater. The news was shocking. It was a lot to process, but Buckley's first thought was about the team.
These 27 guys, where are they going to go next year?
He quickly called the team together. They heard the news the same time he did, and even though they were in the middle of playoff prep, he gave them a choice. Do you want to go home, or do you want to get out on the ice?
Hockey is like our getaway. All the problems go away once you hit the ice, and I think that's everyone. What everyone wanted to do was just kind of forget about it and just do the thing that we love the most.
That's defenseman Sam Holey. The Northland women's team was also preparing for a playoff game. Forward Kennedy Grucke says the closure was hard to believe, but they knew the college was struggling. Northland nearly closed the previous year and raised over $1 million to keep the doors open. But Grucke says they were promised they'd have more time.
All the incoming freshmen from last year assumed that they'd be able to graduate the year after. Recruits that came in were told that they'd be able to graduate as well.
That week was a whirlwind. Grucke's teammate Rachel Fusi says it brought the community together, but putting on her Northland jersey for the last time was really hard, especially knowing it would be the last time anyone put on that jersey.
We're leaving all our best friends behind, and it was very emotional, and for me, it was almost hard to focus on the game because I was so caught up in what's going to happen after this.
On the same day he learned the college was closing, Shane Buckley got an email from Beloit College. And they didn't have a hockey program, but they were interested in starting one by bringing in Northland's players and coaches. Buckley told his seniors, like Holey, but didn't want to get the team's hopes up too much in case the opportunity fell through.
Last year, you know, I was the only captain on the team, and he kind of put that trust in me. So to show him that I have trust in him, I was just like, hey, wherever you end up going, like, that's where I want to be.
Quickly after, Buckley and other coaches took a trip from Ashland on Wisconsin's northern tip down to the southern border to visit Beloit. Karen Shadeen is Beloit's VP for Enrollment, Marketing, and Athletics. She's the one who reached out to Buckley that first day. And as the college tries to increase enrollments and athletic offerings, here in Wisconsin, she says ice hockey seemed like a no-brainer.
It's sad to see another institution close. So really, our thought process was all about getting students a new home. Where could they go?
And it was a good fit. 37 students transferred from Northland to Beloit, only a few of whom were not on the hockey teams. It's a lot, especially considering Northland's enrollment had fallen to just about 250 near the end. Shadeen says they tried to make enrollment as easy as possible so players weren't scared of credits not transferring.
We took the approach that we were just onboarding them as Beloit students as opposed to putting someone through an admissions process.
That took a lot of stress off of senior defenseman Trey Taylor. He's one of the Canadians on the team, and the visa process makes everything complex, and he wasn't sure if he could afford to pay for an extra year of school if credits didn't move properly.
Especially with the exchange rate, too, it's not really too kind right now, so trying to find possibly a school that fits my budget. So that was kind of the real hard part about it, is there's a lot of panic kind of setting in.
Holey says it's been a smooth transition for the team, athletically, socially, and academically. In fact, he says with Northland's enrollment falling these past few years, it really limited some academic opportunities.
Our last year, most of our business classes, if not all of them, were online. So we were basically teaching ourselves because they were in the transition of getting new business professors. But unfortunately, they couldn't hire any to move up there and live up there.
He says Beloit's athletic facilities are newer and they have more training resources. They're also playing at the brand new Woodman Center in Janesville, which Holey says will hopefully help with recruitment. That was difficult the last few years at Northland with the school on the brink of closure. Last year, the women's team couldn't skate with a full team. Now, both squads have a full roster, including other transfers and new freshmen. About two-thirds of the men's and a little less than half of the women's team are from Northland. And Buckley says that Beloit feels like home now, and getting back onto the ice has been a relief after the stress and uncertainty of these past few months.
It's led to a really good dynamic in our locker room right now, where it's not much is taken for granted, because they know how, you know, based on our situation just a few months ago, things can change pretty quickly. So
the women's team recently played its first game, and forward Rachel Fusi says she could really feel the energy.
Our last game was really emotional, but this game is like, it's kind of like almost like a deep breath moment, like, oh, we made it, we're here, like this is happening, like we're having a season together, and it's something really special.
And crowds packed into the Woodman Center for the men's home opener. The puck drops for the first ever Beloit Buccaneers hockey season. But just because they're building something new doesn't mean they have to forget about their Northland roots. The former Northlanders have stickers on their helmet to commemorate their old school, and Buckley says even the jerseys retired at Northland are honored in Beloit.
Being an alumni, like, Northland and Northland hockey was always, you know, very special to me. So to be able to go back and be the last coach at Northland, and be able to keep those Northland traditions alive here, it has meant a lot for sure.
The Bucks fall behind 1-0, but in the second period, Beloit hits the equalizer. It's a hard-fought game. They trade power plays, the sides shove each other into the boards. Beloit ends up losing this one 4-2. But these teams have faced plenty of adversity before. They know this game's a privilege. They'll pick themselves off the ice and move forward. And they hope their brand of resilience will set the standard for the future of Beloit hockey. For one more sports story, the men's cross-country team at North Central College in Naperville is one of the most successful in the country. For over 50 years, that team was guided by Coach Al Carius, and he died this fall at 83 years old, and I got to talk with the team and coaches about his legacy. It's a cold November afternoon, and coaches are raking leaves at a park along the DuPage River as the team runs by. A sign near the road lists all 19 of North Central's national championships.
The history that I'm aware of is Al Carius brought the team here way back in the 60s, and we've been coming here ever since, so almost 60 years now.
That's head coach Matt Sinnott. He took over a few years ago when Al and legendary assistant coach Frank Grammaroso retired. Sinnott, like most of the coaching staff, ran for Al as a student and then came back to coach with him. Al started coaching at North Central back in 1966. And since then, the team has won 50 consecutive conference championships, and he was named the Coach of the Century by fellow coaches. He created countless traditions during his half-century run, and one of them is happening right now. That's why those coaches are raking leaves during one of the last practices before regionals.
We'll make a tunnel, and they'll do their ceremonial last lap, you know, the last lap at Lincoln Park as seniors, and then we'll toss leaves up.
The small group of seniors jog in as the team cheers and rains leaves down on them. It's been a tough year. The team's mourning Al while also trying to stay focused and compete. But it's moments like this that remind them of his philosophy, run for fun and personal best. Sinnott says when he arrived at North Central as a student in the late 90s, it sounded simple.
On the surface was just like, okay, they value you getting better. But as a coach now and having been around this philosophy and program for almost 30 years, it's like, okay, now I understand all those little levels of what that is. It's such a profound philosophy, run for fun and personal best.
For one, it says nothing about your competition. It's just about you.
You can always be better than yesterday, but you can't always guarantee you're going to be better than the guy next to you.
Assistant coach Dale Kopnik has also had a lot of time to think about what it means to run for fun and personal best. He ran for Al in the late 70s, where his team captured 3 national titles. But he says it's not the championships that he and his teammates remember. It's running with your friends every day. It's the traditions, the pre-race meals, and the silly songs they sing during morning runs.
But no one talked about times or places, and that kind of fades. But the feelings and the love you have for each other, that doesn't fade. That stays pretty strong.
Al shared a lot of quotes and sayings, and one of them was, you can give someone the best training in the world, but if they don't believe in it and they're not having fun, they won't get better. And similarly, even the best running philosophy only gets you so far if people don't believe in it. Sinnott says run for fun and personal best worked because they knew Al cared. He knew that as a runner, and then he saw it behind the scenes as a coach, how Al handled tough conversations like who to leave off the roster for regionals.
If I quote Al, the most agonizing decisions, and having been a part of those conversations and how he handled that with empathy and humanity, and he never wanted to hurt anybody's feelings, but he also wanted to make the best decision for the team.
Jacob Kluckhohn is a senior on the current team, and he's dealt with a lot of injuries throughout his career, which has changed how he thinks about their philosophy.
It can also just be what your personal best is on that given day. And a lot of times that changes.
Run for Fun is about running with your friends, and for him and many others, it's running with family. Kluckhohn's known Al since way before he enrolled at North Central. His mom's been the head women's track coach since he was a kid.
I grew up with, Al being kind of like a grandpa figure for me, like grew up around the program a lot.
He says some of his earliest memories are running around Al's office grabbing candy. And he was like a grandfather to Kluckhohn, but Al's literal grandson is also on the team, a freshman this year. And Kluckhohn says that meant Al was around a lot more at meets and practices this fall, despite his retirement and health.
He had to see his grandson race his first collegiate cross-country race, which is awesome. It was within a couple days after that he passed. It's been difficult, but at the same time, I think the thing that's been awesome for our program has been just the outpouring of support from alum that maybe haven't reconnected in such a long time, or we've seen it at every meet we've gone to.
Kopnik says they invited Al back a few times over the past few years to speak to the team, and even very sick with cancer, he lit up with energy and enthusiasm when he spoke.
And he couldn't even stand for very long, but he did at those team meetings. And if you close your eyes, you would think it was when I was in school, 1978. It was still the same vigor, and the message was powerful. So he was doing that until very, very near the end there. I had to turn around last time when he's doing it, because he'd always throw a joke or two in there and that would go over the kids' heads. And I'd just have to turn around because I'd be laughing.
Run for fun and personal best is a running philosophy, but it also became a life philosophy. Kopnik says those principles apply to almost everything.
It's interesting because some guys get it right away and others don't while they're in school, but they get it a few years later. So they've taken those lessons and applied them in their work or their marriage.
Sinnott says the philosophy also worked because generations of students saw it embodied in Al. Even decades into his coaching career, when he'd won a dozen titles and could have walked off into the sunset, he kept innovating and evolving the program to give them an edge.
I think people are drawn to passion, and he just lived a life of passion for what he did, and he was a magnet for that.
It's why former students like Sinnott, Kopnik, and a host of volunteers and coaches have felt called to come back and work with Al over the years. A few days before the conference race this fall, Sinnott and some coaches were walking on campus while the team was out for one of their morning runs when they came across an older woman walking down the sidewalk.
And she stopped us and she said, "Hey, have you heard anything about the old man with the cane who walks over here in the mornings?"
They knew she was talking about Al, and they had to break the bad news. He'd passed about a month before.
She kind of sunk a little bit, and she's like, "Well, he was such a nice man, and he always talked to me. You know, that reminded me of who he was."
The next day, Sinnott shared that story with the team. She had no idea he was the coach of the century. She didn't know about the championships, but she knew about his kindness.
You know, as spiritual as that might sound, that interaction with that woman on Monday just reminded me that he is still around in some way, and he's never going to not be around.
Sinnott sees himself as a steward of that legacy and Al's philosophy. The Cardinals recently collected their 51st straight conference title, and they finished 10th at Nationals. But the lifelong pursuit to run for fun and personal best goes on. And finally, the last story I have for you is from December. Over the past few years, the number of students classified as homeless has increased significantly at a few Northern Illinois schools, and some of those are outliers compared to the rest of their district, and I want to figure out why. Two elementary schools 7 miles apart, Richmond Elementary and Wegner. Richmond is in St. Charles, where their percentage of low-income students is just a fraction of the state average. Wegner is in West Chicago, where it's a good deal above it. But both schools have seen a sharp increase in their homeless student population over the past few years. The state average is 3%, but it's around 18% at Wegner, and at Richmond, it's 21% of students. And in a district like St. Charles, Richmond's an outlier. In West Chicago, Wegner's more of a trend.
Man, they come in here, they stop first in the meat area.
Daisy Martinez with the People's Resource Center walks me through the aisles of a food bank she helps run. We're in a West Chicago school building, and a majority of the 100 families who shop here have kids in the district. There are schools on either side of the building, and the pantry opens up after school, so Martinez says parents often stop by with their kids when they pick them up.
That or before their kid goes to the other events, like orchestra, band, and
like sports and stuff. So I see some kids come through with their gear on and they're like, are we ready to go? And I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm trying to get you through, I promise.
Sarah Norden says the pantry is one of many community resources the district is part of and can point parents towards. She's the West Chicago Elementary School District's Director of Partnerships, and she's also their McKinney-Vento liaison. McKinney-Vento is the federal law that guarantees the right to education for homeless students. And homeless in this context means they don't have fixed, regular, or adequate housing. Often that looks like families doubled up because they can't afford a place on their own. And Norden says McKinney-Vento is also a funding source to help those students get transportation, clothes, and school supplies.
We have 450 students who are McKinney-Vento eligible from our Bursa 3 program all the way to 8th grade.
In West Chicago, Wegner's seen a big increase over the past few years, but so is the whole district. In 2019, fewer than 2% of the district students qualified as homeless. This year, it's 10%. That's a 400% increase. And Norton says that's partially because of economic conditions and partially because they're getting better at identifying homeless students. Pre-pandemic, she says it was on parents during registration to self-identify that they had unstable housing.
So we did update registration processes and make sure there's a question in our annual student registration that asks about unstable housing. And it lists those three things, like, are you doubled up? Are you in adequate housing? Is it consistent? So anytime somebody checks that box during registration, we now follow up with them.
She says they've also been trained to identify the warning signs of homelessness, but there are also just more homeless students now. And that's for multiple reasons, from rising cost of living to the fact that they've had two major apartment fires over the past few years that displaced families overnight. But why are the numbers so much bigger at Wegner Elementary, where nearly 18% of their students are homeless? Norton says it's near one of their largest apartment complexes where families are doubled up.
It's not because, oh, we all get along and we want to share housing. It's because they can't afford rent anywhere in West Chicago without combining their finances and living together. And it's not necessarily both families' names on the lease. It's very easy if you were to get caught that you'd be at risk of losing housing, both the person who has their name on the lease and the other family staying with them.
She says the district works closely with community partners to provide case management and after-school programming for those students, but it's particularly hard because once families are priced out of West Chicago, the surrounding suburbs are usually even more expensive. One of those surrounding suburbs is neighboring St. Charles, home to Richmond Elementary, which has a rate of homelessness about 10 times higher than the rest of their school district. Atlee Smith is the district's family community liaison.
A lot of people hear St. Charles and they think, well, we don't have low-income housing here. We don't have affordable housing. And that, I think, is one of the biggest, you know, misconceptions that I've really worked hard to bust.
2 years ago, the district shifted school boundaries and reclassified Richmond from an intermediate to an elementary school, and they knew it could concentrate more low-income students at Richmond and a few other schools. And they had a lot of community partners who wanted to help, but they needed to be more deliberate. So this year, they created an essential needs form to help get students the things the district can't purchase with McKinney-Vento money.
Maybe it's prom tickets or it's track shoes. And we will take that need from our social worker, our school staff, put it into our essential needs form. It'll go out to our community lead, and she will email everyone in that network, and someone will say, I'll grab them.
Smith helps compile a monthly calendar with frequently needed items depending on the season, like Halloween costumes in September. The St. Charles School District also partners with the nonprofit Big Hearts of Fox Valley to help get Christmas presents for their McKinney-Vento families. They recently held their Santa's drive-through event on a cold December night, and families like this one pulled up in their cars to pick up the presents.
So I'm a foster mom and of two little boys who have a homeless status, and it just means the world to get these presents for them. They get so overwhelmed and overjoyed. They've never seen anything like it. So it also just blesses our family and provides tremendous support for us as a foster family.
Big Hearts works directly with the school district social workers to get kids wish lists so people in the community can buy for them. This year, they gave away well over 10,000 gifts. And Smith says it is possible that they'll continue to see high levels of homelessness at schools like Richmond, but she says she feels confident that they now have the systems in place to support those kids. All right, that is all I have got for you today. really hope that you've enjoyed all of my education reporting this year. And if you have any ideas, if you've got stories you think we should be covering, please send those ideas my way. You can shoot me an email at teachersLounge@niu.edu. And thank you so much to everyone for listening over the past year. Again, as always, please feel free to nominate a teacher in your life to be on the show as well. Send those our way also to teachersLounge@niu.edu. Wherever you're hearing this show, please leave us a rating, share it with a friend. It's the best way to get even more perspectives on the show in the new year. And we will be back very soon with more Teachers Lounge. I've been your host, Peter Medlin. Thanks so much for being here.